This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. What was I about to say? That unnerving feeling that you've lost your train of thought is apparently a symptom of normal memory loss as you get older, along with forgetting people's names and the name of the movie you just saw and where you left your keys. My guest, Martha Weinman Lear, has written a new book called Where Did I Leave My Glasses? The What, When, and Why of Normal Memory Loss. She's a journalist who's written extensively about medical issues. She's also the author of a 1980 memoir about the death of her first husband and what it was like for him when he went from being a doctor to being a patient. Martha Weinman Lear, welcome to Fresh Air. Why were you worried enough about your memory that you actually went to the doctor to have it tested?
Oh, goodness. I was having trouble remembering names. I'd walk into rooms and forget why I had gone into them. I would forever be asking my husband, what was the name of that movie we saw last week? I would say, what was I just going to say? All that kind of thing. But where it really got most troubling for me was at the desk, because as a nonfiction writer, I have to take masses of research material and organize them in a fluid and hopefully reasonably graceful way. And no one's ever accused me of being well organized. So that was becoming more difficult. I'd have the perfect thought of how to segue from one point to another flash into my consciousness, and in the next instant it was out, gone, goodbye. And that was enough finally to worry me and send me to a neurologist. And he put me through a battery of tests, assured me that I was fine, at least so far as my memory was concerned, and that it was normal and universal for this kind of memory to begin slowing down in middle age. I floated home reassured, and I've been reassured ever since, and I think my memory is probably better as a result of relaxing about it.
So what kind of tests did the neurologist give you to see whether you're having normal or abnormal memory loss?
He would ask me, for example, to enumerate as many vegetables as I could, ask me to name fruits, ask me to recite months backward, days of the week backward, give me a list of words, let a couple of minutes pass, and then ask me to repeat the words, tests of that sort.
And what's the point of asking you to name fruits and vegetables?
When people are perhaps in the early stages of Alzheimer's or some other form of dementia, they begin typically having problems with that kind of naming.
Now, you have problems with naming. You forget people's names and movies' names and actors' names. But fruits and vegetables, that's like in a different category. That stays with you.
Yes, Terry. We have many different kinds of memory. Fruits and vegetables, items that we have been familiar with all of our lives, facts, generally, facts, things that we know about the world, are parts of what is called semantic memory. Semantic memory would be, what are eyeglasses for? To be able to answer that, one would have to have intact semantic memory. But if one asked, where did I leave my eyeglasses, that is what's called episodic memory, which covers all of personal experience, and that's the kind of memory that typically begins to slow up on us in middle years.
And where do fruits and vegetables fit in?
They're part of semantic memory. The difference would be the Empire State Building is in New York City. That is semantic memory. We went on a tour of the Empire State Building last week. That would be episodic memory.
You describe memory as a three-stage drama. There's acquisition, storage, and retrieval. What are some of the things that can go wrong each step of the way?
The very first thing that can and so often does go wrong is that you're not paying attention. And every neuroscientist I spoke to, and I interviewed many of the most distinguished ones in the country, every one of them stresses that paying attention is the most important primary part of the process, because obviously, if you don't pay attention, it never gets in there. It's never stored. It's just gone. Beyond that, what can go wrong is that a memory is formed by chemical and electrical impulses traveling along the networks of neurons in the brain. Scientists estimate, I can't imagine how they count them, but they estimate that there are at least 100 billion, with a B as in boy, 100 billion neurons in the human brain. Some think there may be as many as 200 billion. And every memory forms its own pattern along those networks of neurons. So you take a particular memory, Terry, it's been stored in long-range memory. Now, every time you retrieve it and then put it back into storage, that pattern of signals is changed so that over time, the memory becomes less and less accurate. The evolutionary biologist Terry Deacon out at UCal Berkeley compares it to a palimpsest, or to writing over writing over writing. And as he says, the ink tends to get lighter as you go along, so that in time, the experience, as you recall it, as you now hold it in memory, will be quite different from the experience as it originally entered your brain.
Is it in part because you embellish it a little differently each time?
You also embellish it. Emotion, you asked what could go wrong. Something else that can and does go wrong is the absence. Say you've had, you recall a memory that pained you, that caused you great grief, or that caused you great joy. Whenever you recall that memory, to whatever degree the emotion is experienced again, is going to affect the way you recall the memory. And so you're going to put it back into storage somewhat different from the way it was in storage before, which is one of the essential differences between brain memory and computer memory. Because you put information into a computer, retrieve it 50, 100 years from now, and it's going to be exactly as it went in. That will not be the case with brain memory.
You know what surprises me about what you're saying? I always think that if you repeat a memory to yourself, you're making it more indelible in your brain by constantly remembering it, and you stand, therefore, a greater likelihood of having a real, genuine memory. And you're saying it's the opposite, that the more you kind of recall it and discuss it, the more changed it's going to become.
Probably. That is the neuroscientific view of the matter. Whereas a memory that is brand new, such as the name of someone you've just been introduced to, that you can, in fact, fix more accurately within your brain by simple repetition. Although what people do typically is, I meet you and I say to myself, Terry, the name is Terry, which won't help a bit. What one should do is what the psychologists call spaced repetition. You say the name to yourself, wait 10 seconds, say it again, wait 20 seconds, repeat it, wait 30 seconds, repeat it. Do that perhaps a half dozen times. You have a far better chance of hanging on to the name.
Now, you said that, you know, when you're learning something, that you have to be paying attention, otherwise the memory isn't going to stick. So many of us, you know, excuse the expression, multitask. We're doing two or three things at the same time. We're reading email while we're on the phone, or listening to music while we're reading, or watching a movie and reading the newspaper on television, you know, reading, watching a movie on television. Does that mean that everything we're doing is less likely to make a good memory impression because we're focused on several things at the same time?
Well, multitasking is one of the three most common early presenting symptoms of this kind of normal garden variety age-related memory loss. Trouble with names, trouble with multitasking, and having it take longer to absorb new information. Because although we talk about memory loss, it isn't really loss so much as it is a slowing down. And so what is advised by specialists who deal with people who are having memory problems insofar as multitasking is concerned is to set strict rules for themselves so that you say, for example, I have to finish this task that is on my desk, and I am going to ignore the email, and I'm not going to answer any phone calls until this task is done. And Dr. Margaret Sewell at the Mount Sinai Memory Enhancement Center here at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York tells me that as soon as the clients who come to see her are able to impose that kind of discipline upon themselves, they're astonished by how much difference it makes and how much more they're able to get done.
So when you reach a certain age, multitasking becomes more difficult if you want to actually remember what you're doing and complete what you're doing.
Yes. But as Dr. Sewell points out, it is not that you can't do it. You simply have to organize your tasks differently. And as for taking longer to process new information, she said to me, and I loved hearing it, she said, if you are physically healthy and you want to learn Italian when you're 90, go ahead, you can do it. It's simply going to take you longer. You're going to need to study harder. You're going to need more rehearsal time. But you can do it every bit as well as the 30-year-old.
So there's certain parts of the brain that start to slow down first?
Well, the frontal lobes start to slow down first. They are, interestingly, the last part of the brain to develop in children. And, you know, last on, first to go.
What do they do? What are they responsible for?
All of episodic memory. Now, I should clarify. Memory is all over the brain. All kinds of memory are all over the brain, but episodic memory relies primarily on the frontal lobes of the brain, and that includes all the kinds of things we're talking about: remembering names, remembering what you had for lunch yesterday, all that kind of thing. But also, the frontal lobes are responsible for what the scientists call executive function. And executive function includes multitasking. It includes paying attention. It includes being able to get distractions out of the way. It includes planning, scheduling, a good many of those functions that we begin to have a little more trouble with in middle age. Those are all part of executive function, which is lodged in the frontal lobes, which begin to lose volume first, as I say. But it's not, for most of us, thank heaven, it's not a serious slowing down. We just perceive it as serious and we get scared because there's a terrific difference in our own perception between a brain that's functioning at 100% and one that's going along at, let's say, 95%.
My guest is Martha Weinman Lear, author of the new book, Where Did I Leave My Glasses? The What, When, and Why of Normal Memory Loss. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Martha Weinman Lear, and for many years she's written about medical issues. Her new book is about memory, her own issues with memory, and what the experts she interviewed across the country told her about memory, how it works and how it fades. And her new book is called Where Did I Leave My Glasses? The What, When, and Why of Normal Memory Loss. You started this book because you were worried about your own memory. You were worried about losing your memory. You got tests. They told you, no, this is just like the type of memory loss that accompanies aging.
Mm-hmm.
As part of your research for the book, you not only interviewed a lot of, you know, neurologists and other experts on memory, you visited hospitals that offer memory-enhancing clinics and looked at what the memory gurus that privately market their techniques to remember had to say. What are some of the most compelling, useful memory techniques that you came across?
The single most important factors in helping us with our normal garden variety memory, I keep saying loss, but really let me keep making the point, it's slowing down. The key factors are diet and exercise. Most of us are familiar with that. We just don't always follow the rules that we know are rules. The specialists all tell me, as far as diet is concerned, that anything that is heart healthy is brain healthy. Now, beyond that, exercise, this is where I got one of the biggest surprises that I experienced in the 2 years I spent doing research. It turns out, I'm talking now about experiments that were done by scientists at the University of Illinois Urbana. They took two groups of adults, middle age to early old age, people who were physically healthy, and put one group into toning and stretching exercises and the other group into aerobic exercises. Kept that up for 6 months, and at the end of 6 months, they found that the people in the aerobic exercise group had gained 15 to 20% speed improvement in cognitive process. Now, that's really an amazing change.
Is there any explanation for it?
Well, yeah, sure. There are two. The first one, I think, is pretty obvious, that when you do aerobic exercise, more blood, more oxygen is going to the brain. But the other, which surprised me, which I was told by Dr. Yakov Stern at Columbia Presbyterian here in New York, who is an eminent neuropsychologist, the other factor is that there is a chemical. It's called B for boy, D for David, and then there are two other letters, and of course I can't remember what they are. But this chemical helps the process of neurotransmission, and aerobics causes more of this chemical to flow.
So what do you do to compensate in areas where you know your memory is weak?
Let's take names. One very common compensation recommended by the specialists is spaced rehearsal, repeating the name to yourself, not rapidly, but several times over a period of time, 10 seconds, 20 seconds, 30 seconds. Another, since memory works by association, is to elaborate in any way you can. Elaboration is part of the process of association and means simply linking what you already know to what you want to remember, so that if I met you for the first time and wanted to remember the name Terry, I would think of other Terrys I might know and mentally visualize the two of you together, because visual memory is much stronger than verbal memory. Or if I were quick enough on my toes, which I'm not always, I might try to make a little poem. Terry is a berry, and see you like a strawberry, or see you holding a strawberry. Another technique, it's kind of boring, but sometimes you hit the jackpot. When you forget somebody's name, you've been introduced, you forget the name, you're talking to that person, somebody else comes along, you need to introduce them, you don't know what to do. That's a problem we all have and are embarrassed by. You can try going through the alphabet, hoping that will give you a clue, you know, Albert, Betty, Charlotte, David, and so forth. What I find when I'm stuck in that kind of situation is that a little dissembling will go a long way. So that, for example, if I'm at a crowded cocktail party and I'm talking to A, whose name I have forgotten, and B comes along, whose name, of course, I have also forgotten, and joins the conversation, what do I do? I have learned not to do anything. I greet B and I keep talking, hoping that the two know each other. If they don't say, well, we haven't met, I'm home free. But if either of them says, we haven't met, I say, oh, excuse me for a moment, I'll be right back, and I run for the nearest exit and hope that by the time I return, those two people whose names I can't remember will be talking to other people whose names, of course, I also won't remember.
Martha Wineman Lear is the author of Where Did I Leave My Glasses? The What, When, and Why of Normal Memory Loss. She'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Martha Wineman Lear, author of the new book, Where Did I Leave My Glasses? The What, When, and Why of Normal Memory Loss. She's a journalist who's written extensively about medical issues. Now, as you get older, it's really interesting to see what you remember vividly and what memories have faded from the past. And you say that the experts have told you that memories of physical pain are not as vivid as, say, emotional memories. And that's kind of really surprising to me, because as somebody who does her best to avoid pain of all types, I always think of memories of pain as being pretty vivid.
Yeah, well, the difference, this fascinated me too. The difference is that when we talk about remembering pain, emotional or physical, what the specialists are telling us is not that you can't remember physical pain, but that we are fully and unfortunately capable of re-experiencing emotional pain years after the event that initially caused the pain. And if you've ever lost anyone dear to you, I lost my first husband some years ago. That was the worst thing that ever happened to me. And it was several years after he had died, I passed a man in the street who walked rather like him and looked just a bit like him, and I dissolved. I was simply reliving the same pain that I had had when the experience was new. Now, physical pain, you can remember, of course, but you cannot, we seem to be incapable of recreating it in the same way, of re-experiencing it. You remember when you broke your arm. You know that you were in a hell of a lot of pain, but you're not re-experiencing the actual pain. And the specialist suggests that the evolutionary reason is fortunate indeed, because if you re-experience emotional pain, it's hard, but you can still get it together to do the things that you need to do, do a day's work and get the kids ready for school and so forth. But if you broke that arm and years later thought of it and re-experienced the pain of it, you'd be out of commission.
The first time I spoke with you was in the late 70s or maybe 1980, and it was after the publication of your memoir, Heart Sounds. The memoir was about your husband, Hal Lear, who was a urologist who had a heart condition, had bypass surgery, and ended up dying at the age of about 58 of complications from the heart condition. And this was really a death that shouldn't have happened. There were mistakes made in the hospital that should have never happened there. It was a very upsetting book to read. And as you've said, the worst thing that's ever happened to you in your life. I always wonder, like, when you lose somebody, what stays with you? What do you remember? What do you forget? What do you wish you were able to remember, but you just can't get at it anymore? And so I'd really like to know, if you wouldn't mind talking about it, if you feel like the memories that you've wanted to stay with you have adequately stuck with you, or do you feel like you sometimes grasp for those vivid memories of your first husband and things that you want to remember aren't there anymore?
Oh, Lord. I think the things that I want to remember have stayed with me. It's not a pain that ever goes away, but what I find reassuring is that what was sheer bitterness in the early years turns in time to a kind of bittersweet, you know? Sure, there's the sadness, and the sadness always remains, but there's also enormous joy in the memory and a feeling of having been blessed to have had that life and to be able to hang on to those memories. I don't think anyone who has ever dearly loved and lost forgets the vital memories that one wants to hang on to. You forget a great deal of the minutiae, so what? But, oh, yeah, sure, I remember.
I know, like, when my mother died, it took me a long time to be able to really remember her when she wasn't sick. Because when
I think
of my mother, I'd always think of the way she was during the last couple of years of her life, when her physical and mental abilities were deteriorating.
Yeah.
I wonder if you went through that, and tell me if this is too personal, but I wonder if you went through that with your husband, that, like, it took a while for memories of his younger and healthier days to really surface in your mind after he died.
Hmm. For a while, I couldn't bear to look at pictures. But then I put them all back up on the wall, and I surrounded myself with pictures of him in his health and vigor. He was a marvelous-looking man. And I must confess that the memories of his appearance toward the end, when he looked skeletal, he looked like a Holocaust survivor. You remember those movie reels we saw of the survivors in the death camps inside those wire fences with the gaunt faces. They looked like death. Hal looked like that in his last year. I try to block those memories out. I don't want them. They stick, of course. But it is those other memories of him robust and healthy and happy that are very vivid indeed. And I'll hang on to those until the day I die.
Now, you mentioned the photographs that you put back up. And this is another thing. I always wonder, when you lose somebody, are your visual memories of them based on the indelible photographs that you have? Are those the pictures that you have in your mind because you have those pictures in front of you? Or are you able to conjure up what the person looked like during various stages of the period that you knew them that aren't from the photographs?
Yeah, yeah. What an interesting question. I can remember moments with extraordinary vividness that I don't have pictures of at all. And there was one. His doctors had told me that he had, at the outside, a year to live. He fooled them. He lived 18 months beyond that. But he said at one point, now mind you, here was a doctor who knew damn well that he was terminal. But he was operating as I think people who are terminal always do. He was operating both with the knowledge and in denial. Even as a doctor, he was able to deny. And he decided at one point that what he needed most was to go out and buy a new suit. And I had some appointment. I had to meet him at the store. And I remember, Terry, oh, Lord, truly as though I were there, I remember walking in and seeing him in a gray flannel jacket, a blazer, and he looked so handsome, and he flashed me this huge smile coming out of that desiccated face. Oh, that has photographic precision for me.
Well, Martha Weidman Lear, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry. It's been lovely.
Martha Weidman Lear is the author of the new book, Where Did I Leave My Glasses? The What, When, and Why of Normal Memory Loss. Earlier this month, President Bush made his final budget proposal to Congress, the first ever to top the $3 trillion mark. Bush's plan would increase military spending and restrain domestic programs, including Medicare and Medicaid. It would also produce a $400 billion deficit, and our guests Scott Biddle and Gene Johnson have a problem with that. As leaders of the nonpartisan think tank Public Agenda, they're on a mission to warn Americans of the dangers posed by the rising national debt, which now stands at $9 trillion. They believe plain talk about the budget crisis is needed to enlighten citizens and move politicians to act. Biddle and Johnson have written a new book called Where Does the Money Go? Your Guided Tour to the Federal Budget Crisis. They spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies, who is a senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News.
Well, Scott Biddle and Gene Johnson, welcome to Fresh Air. You know, I've covered As a newspaper reporter, city and state budgets for years, and I find that they generally have a requirement that legislatures and city councils pass annual budgets that are balanced. And while that can be fudged a little with a phony revenue estimate or tax estimate, you can't just borrow for operating expenses. The federal government is different. Why?
Well, the federal government does not have a balanced budget provision for a lot of reasons, mostly because the founders didn't think it was necessary and no one's gotten the votes together since to do it. But I think the main thing is that deficit spending has become routine in Washington because there is no actual requirement other than a general belief in good government to bring the budget into balance. It's the default setting to run a deficit, and we've done it for 31 out of the last 35 years. There's simply no strong political incentive to bring it into line.
Now, there's a view that the national debt and the annual deficit, the numbers are gargantuan, but there's a view that what really matters is not the size of the debt in nominal terms, but its size in relation to the nation's economy, the gross domestic product. By that measure, how do we stack up in our debt, and is it a fair measure?
Well, I think that, you know, by that measure, the debt is not that large compared to the economy as a whole. We have a huge economy. But if you think of it another way, we're now spending more than $200 billion a year on interest on the debt, and that's actually more than we're spending on the war in Iraq. So it's beginning to be a very large portion of the budget. But I think the issue is not that there is a debt in any one single year. It's the fact that it's become business as usual in Washington. And we have this huge debt building up year after year to $9 trillion. And we are facing down the road these humongous expenses for the baby boomer retirements and for Medicare, 78 million Americans who will be coming up to Social Security and Medicare benefits.
Let's take care of one technical question here. A lot of people say that when the federal government doesn't have enough money to pay its bills, it simply rolls the printing presses. It's a metaphor. That, of course, is not what happens. What happens is what? They issue bonds, right? Federal Treasury notes, which are then bought by investors, right?
That's right. And those are available for sale for anyone. At the moment, one of the biggest things that's going on is roughly a quarter of this is owned by foreigners. Japan, China, Great Britain, basically because this is a safe place to park their money. The problem down the line is some other place may be a safer place for them. Alternatively, you might end up in a dispute with another country like China, and it gives them the possibility of an economic weapon.
Let's pursue that for one second, because there's been a lot of attention to China buying a lot of federal treasury bonds. And let's say down the road they want to punish the United States for some measure, and as you say, they want their money back. Well, the fact is that what they have is a treasury note with a payment schedule on it. I mean, they can't simply demand immediate repayment. What they would have to do is try to sell that U.S. Treasury security on the open market, right? What happens if they do that? What's the harm in that?
Well, were they to try and dump their treasury bonds all at once, that would really provoke a world economic crisis. And I don't think, and most of the foreign policy experts we talk to, don't think that's terribly likely, just because China needs stable markets too, and disorder in the world financial markets doesn't benefit them either. What they can do, however, is simply slow down, because all the other world financial traders are waiting for a sign that China no longer wants to fund our deficit spending.
You say that you mean they slow down buying U.S. treasury
bonds? They slow
down
buying more. And then other people also start slowing down. Interest rates go up, not just on treasury bills, because the government would most likely raise the interest rates to make them more attractive. But the interest rates would probably go up for everybody, which means your mortgage would cost more, your car loan would cost more. It would hurt the economy across the board.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about how we've gotten here over the past few years. You know, we've been hearing about, you know, very troubling and large federal deficits since the 1970s and through the 1980s. And then in the late 90s, we saw the federal government actually begin to run budget surpluses. Why?
Well, I think it was a combination of factors, and it was really remarkably bipartisan. One was a booming economy, which helps considerably. Another was that the first President Bush and a Democratic Congress were willing to raise taxes to deal with the budget issues at that time. And then President Clinton and a Republican Congress were willing to stick to some fairly strict spending rules to control spending during going forward. So that combination of factors, that combination of bipartisanship and fiscal discipline really brought things under control, at least in terms of the year-to-year budget. They did very little at the end of the day about the long-term problems of the entitlements like Social Security and Medicare.
Right, and they didn't chip away much at the accumulated debt, but they stopped adding to it for a while. Now how did we get into the situation we're in now where deficits have grown enormously once again?
Well, I think that it's, you know, in some ways it's really no secret. We made very popular tax cuts. They were broadly supported. We had expenses for the war in Iraq and for all of the national security needs after September 11th. We've added a drug benefit to Medicare. We have increased spending for all the popular programs. And, you know, there has not been any kind of political pressure to make the choices that would get the budget back in balance again. And, you know, ironically, this has happened when we have had a booming economy and when revenues to the Treasury are up.
Well, let's talk. You mentioned the Bush tax cuts, which you said were broadly popular. There is, of course, the argument of supply-siders is that cutting taxes, you know, empowers, you know, the entrepreneurial class. It generates spending and therefore boosts the economy, which in turn boosts revenues. Looking at the numbers, how well does that argument hold up? Do the tax cuts generate enough revenue to pay for themselves?
Well, you know, it's an interesting question because revenues to the Treasury were up after the Bush tax cuts. And, you know, the tax cuts do, you know, generate some revenue. The problem is they don't generate enough revenue to pay for themselves. And so that you have even conservative economists who've studied this, you know, coming out with studies that show that tax cuts pay for 20, perhaps 30% of the loss to the Treasury. So you still have that 70 or 80% to cover.
One more question about how we moved from the surpluses in the late 90s to the huge deficits that we see today. How much of the federal budget deficits that we are seeing today are the result of the war in Iraq?
I think that is one of the most striking misconceptions we've run into in researching the book. Certainly, we've spent a great deal on the war, but the war itself is not the cause of the financial problems. Since between 2001 and 2007, the Congressional Budget Office says we spent about $600 billion on the war on terrorism in general. That's Iraq and Afghanistan and everything else. Over the same period, the national debt increased to $2.3 trillion. It's certainly true that spending on the war has added to our financial problems. But the fact is, it's not the sole cause.
If you're just joining us, our guests are Scott Biddle and Gene Johnson. They're associated with the nonpartisan website Public Agenda Online, and they are authors of a new guided tour to the federal budget crisis. It's called Where Does the Money Go? Let's talk a little bit about federal spending. One of the things that you do in this book is to break down federal spending by category, and you find that certain things surprise people about how their federal dollars are allocated. What is most surprising about where our federal checks go to people?
I think what's most surprising when we talk to focus groups about this is how little of the federal budget really goes to the things that a lot of people will pick as their targets for cuts. So people will talk about the space program or the endowments for the humanities and the arts, or they'll talk about welfare. And, you know, the kind of this farm subsidies is another one that comes up. And, you know, the problem, if you sort of add these programs all together, you're really getting less than 5% of the budget. The big expenses are on Social Security, on Medicare, on defense, and on interest on the debt.
And you point out that a lot of the things that really tick people off, things like farm subsidies. I mean, in fact, you have one case in the book of a guy who has an asphalt lot behind him, his house, and he's paid not to grow rice on there, which he never intended to do, and various other outrages don't add up to a lot of money, but you say they're important nonetheless. Why?
The importance of waste and fraud and pork barrel spending and earmarks and all these kind of extremely frustrating things about the federal budget isn't that they add up to a lot, as you said. The most aggressive definition of earmarks I have seen is about $1.6 billion in the total budget. The budget for the coming year will probably be $400 billion in deficit. So you don't balance the budget by getting rid of that. The real problem with that is trust. This is what makes people cynical about the federal government and how federal spending is allocated. When we've done focus groups on the federal budget at Public Agenda, what we found is once people understand the problem, they're willing to consider making sacrifices. They're willing to consider changes in benefits, changes in taxes to solve the problems. But they won't make those sacrifices if they think the money's going to be wasted.
We're speaking with Scott Biddle and Gene Johnson. Their new book is Where Does the Money Go? Your Guided Tour to the Federal Budget Crisis. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, our guests are Scott Biddle and Gene Johnson. They're both affiliated with the nonpartisan website Public Agenda Online, and they've written a book. It's a new guided tour to the federal budget crisis called Where Does the Money Go? Well, let's talk about Social Security and Medicare, which is the really, really big looming problem for the federal deficit. And in a snapshot, how big is the problem? How quickly does it descend upon us? And what do we do about it?
Well, you know, it's interesting because we often talk about Social Security and Medicare as if they are the same, and in fact, they are quite different. And Medicare is already in trouble financially, and it's in trouble financially because it's set up a little differently. But the major problem is that healthcare costs are going up so rapidly. So already that program is facing enormous strain.
The Medicare really brings these two problems together. One is the 78 million baby boomers, and the other is healthcare costs, which are skyrocketing in any case, just throughout the national healthcare system. So when you bring these together in Medicare, you end up with something that is actually much, much worse than Social Security in terms of its impact on the budget. If you project out the obligations, as the government auditors have done, over the next, 75 years or so, you're talking about $32 trillion in Medicare obligations compared to $6.5 trillion for Social Security. Or to put it another way, if you wanted to fix this and you could raise taxes or cut benefits any way you wanted, to put Social Security in balance for another 75 years, you could raise taxes by 16%. Or you could cut benefits by 13%, or some combination in between. Again, politically, could you do that? That's another question. To fix Medicare for 75 years, you'd have to raise taxes 122% or cut benefits in half. I think that gives you an idea of how much larger the Medicare problem is.
As somebody who considers myself a pretty informed citizen, and I've actually, as a reporter, covered budgets in state and local governments, I have to say that I find the federal budget process utterly bewildering. I mean, continuing resolutions and 13 different budget bills that are introduced and debated separately. Am I wrong, or is it the mess that it appears to be to me?
Oh, you're not wrong. It is an extremely complicated process. The president submits a budget request. Congress then passes its own budget resolution. Neither of those necessarily are reflected in the 13 different spending bills. The 13 different spending bills do not necessarily factor in Social Security and Medicare, which are running on autopilot. We actually, in the book, looked at a few other countries and different ways they go about this. New Zealand works with a system of budget targets that are set. So does the Netherlands. New Zealand actually has a remarkable system where government auditors put out estimates of the financial impact of campaign promises made by the various parties during the election.
Wow, that would be
which I'm not sure how that would actually work in practice here. But there are different structural ways of going about this that could make the system a little more rational.
I think the other part of it, there are all these kind of structural ideas. But on the other hand, not so long ago, within memory of most of us, our political memories, there were bipartisan deals on the budget. And there were agreements that the parties got together, where the administration and the Congress got together and decided to try to get a more fiscally responsible plan for the future. And there's no reason that if the American people want that and start asking tough questions, we can't get back to that kind of state of mind.
Well, Scott Biddle and Gene Johnson, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Thank you.
Scott Biddle and Gene Johnson are the authors of Where Did the Money Go? Your Guided Tour to the Federal Budget Crisis, and they're executive vice presidents of the think tank Public Agenda. They spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies, a senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News.